out to be completely unreliable assholes.
Konnichiwa, Tim-san.
Hello, Ryan.
And hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 152 of Dismembering Horror, the podcast sure where myself, Ryan McDuffie, and...
myself, Tim Aslan.
That's right. We dismember, just like the name of our podcast, we dismember a horror film every week. We talk about what worked for us, what did not work for us, and anything else we found interesting or noteworthy. We're on a grand epic quest to see all the sight unseen for Tim and myself in the realm of horror and to revisit the long since seen, all that good stuff. And we're here to talk about it afterwards and digest it, which, as we find, and we hope you find too, horror offers plenty to chew on and then indeed digest. Yeah. Yep. And today, from 1960, from Japan, Jigoku.
Yep.
Great.
Hell.
Exactly. Translated to hell. Cool. Tim, before we get into Jigoku, a couple orders of business. First, since we recorded our episode on Damien Omen 2 weeks ago, we were talking about the first one. I told you my Richard Donner anecdote, who directed the first one. You know, you're nodding. He passed away yesterday as of recording this.
I blame you.
June. Thanks. June 5th. So, so if you heard that episode, you know, we record these a couple weeks behind when they come out. So that's why we didn't mention it then. But boy, I wanted to mention it now. My anecdote I told about him real quick was when I told him, I met him and told him that Omen was one of my favorite horror movies. And as I described him then as a real yuckster, he just responded, "Yeah, me too." Tim shaking his head again.
It's just such a dad. It's such a dad joke. It's so Dick Donner of him.
Yeah, you're always making dad joke attempts, Tim.
Attempts? How dare you?
Great. So yeah, the great director of many a wonderful film, Richard Donner. Thank you for your work. Rest in peace. And now, Tim, for the other order of business, I had an inquiry from a listener of ours.
Whoa.
Who noted that it would seem that I tend to like more movies than you, or on a spectrum. There'll be more movies that I like that you don't. And so he asked, are there any that you, Tim, have liked that I have not? Now, I could only think of two in all of our 151 episodes before this where there was only one clear one and one that was, I think, just a lower rating, but I didn't necessarily dislike it. Now, can you think of what those are?
Oh, my God. Can I? What did I like more than you? That's a really good question.
Let's build on the ones I thought of. I don't want to, I mean, why?
You thought of them right off the top of your head?
No, I don't look at them.
Or you had to look?
Yeah. So the first one that I saw and thought of was Demon from 2015.
Oh, I know one.
Which, if you remember, I gave...
Wait, Demon. Which one is Demon?
That was the one at the wedding.
Where was that?
I went as far as to give that as an avoid, apparently.
That's right.
And you gave it a rent.
Mm-hmm. I can think of one that I like that you don't like didn't like very much.
The last one that I had was way early on, Planet of the Vampires. I liked it, but you gave a higher rating to it.
I also liked Starry Eyes, and you did not.
I liked it.
Well, you didn't like it as much as I like it.
Indeed. And that was the inquiry. Yeah. I'd forgotten about that one, too.
I'm, you know, just a curmudgeon. What do you want?
I don't know what it is, but it's interesting.
Well, I think you have a wider, I don't know what you would call it, a wider acceptance. You know, like you can get into a thing in spite of its crappiness.
Yeah.
And I have a much harder time with that.
Except for also the remake, one of the remakes, the 2020 remake of The Grudge. We went in theaters and saw it. We both said avoid, I believe.
I would hope.
But I was more viscerally mad than you, I think. So
I think that, do you think, I don't know if we addressed this or touched on it at all, but do you think that that's because you hold The Grudge and Ju-on in it's more personal and like more of your thing that you love?
I think
that's that much more offensive.
It's hard because that was definitely like icing on the cake that made me sadder, but it didn't make the movie, like the movie was plenty bad on its own, even if I wasn't a fan. So
yeah,
so yes and no, I guess.
True. It was all the, it was the whole experience.
Yeah.
But remember those seats?
Yeah, good seats. Right in front.
Real cushy. Like loungy.
At the Universal City Walk.
Yep.
After half an hour of trailers.
We probably would have been better off just going to sleep.
Yes,
they're
but
comfortable.
We have a job to do here, Tim. As we do. As we do today, too.
You know what movie I loved that you hated? The Girl Next Door.
That was sarcastic, everyone. Tim hated that, too. We both did not like that.
Okay, you're right.
Great. Well, listener, you know who you are. There's a little bit on that. I think that's what we could dig up there. All right. Well, we got another full movie to talk about today, Tim. We got to travel to Jigoku and back. And we start that like we do every episode with a trailer. Are you ready, Tim, for the trailer for Jigoku?
I'm ready to not like it. How's that? Just to carry on the theme.
Great. Perfect. All right, here we go. As I just said, from 1960, from Japan, Jigoku. Jigoku, directed by Nobuo Nakagawa. Screenplay also by Nobuo Nakagawa and Ichiro Miyagawa. There you go.
There you go.
Well, Tim, after our trailer comes our rating. So, per our rating system, would you, Timothy Ryan Aslan, tell yourself to avoid it, stream it, rent it, or buy it?
I'm after a day, I'd say I sort of floated into a low rent from a high stream.
Great. You had no idea what those words meant. A low rent. Floated from a low rent. No, a high stream to a low rent.
Yep.
Great. Floating in streams is apropos for this one.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I think pretty much from the opening credits, no matter what, I was a rent it. Like,
I mean, that's fair.
It was, it had its highs and lows. I feel like if I watched it again, I'd probably follow it better. This was definitely one of those where it was like, wait, there's the same actor and she's playing different characters and like, everyone dies by a car accident and what, you know, you're like trying to put it all together. Yeah,
it's a little,
it's like
convoluted.
Kind of, yeah. Maybe. There's like just, it's all like a kind of a soap opera going on.
Right.
With like gangsters. And then we're just in hell for the second half. And great. Yeah. You can follow it or not at that point.
That's right.
But yeah, no, just the feel of it, the creativity, the strangeness from the opening credits. Yeah. You know, it luckily went back to that by the
end. Thank God, because there was, I got worried.
Yeah. Right. It set you up for something.
And I was like, I hope we get to go to hell.
Yeah.
We did.
Yes, indeed. Right. And there were those first shots at the beginning, too, that right. we kind of repeated later. So anyway, for all that, and I'm always interested in and have a soft spot for Japanese horror. So yeah, I got to give it a rent. Solid rent.
Cool.
All right. Well, with that, after we just set up how convoluted it was and is, Tim, I'm looking to you.
I can do this, right?
For our summary.
Okay, so you got a guy. Shiro. And he's engaged, and he's got a kind of a, just not a cool best friend who, you know, whatever, don't worry about it. But what's his name?
Tamura.
Tamura, right. So Tamura is kind of a jerk. He's just that guy. He's that guy that's just kind of always popping up.
Literally in this sense.
Yeah, that keeps happening. Anyway, so Shiro's got a fiance. Damn it. Remind me of her name too.
Oh, his girlfriend, Yukiko.
Right, Yukiko. So.
Who's the daughter of his professor.
Who is the daughter of his professor. Oh, man. This gets, it's quite wild, actually. But just the family tree of it all is quite wild. But the gist of the story is that Shiro and his best bud, who sucks, hit a drunk guy on their way home. And they don't know if they've killed him, but, Shiro feels very guilty. His friend kind of is like, well, whatever. If you say anything, you're responsible too because you told me to take this route home. Which is just the stupidest argument. But okay, dude. And he gets him with it. You know, he gets under Shiro's skin and in his head. So, oh my God. So, they get very anxious. They find out that the guy did die. And that guy's girlfriend or wife, girlfriend, let's say, and mother decide that they are going to exact revenge. They're going to figure out who killed their loved one, and they're going to kill him. So that's our first story setup of the story. Then all hell kind of breaks loose. Shiro goes out of town to his mom because she's dying. His dad runs a kind of like a convalescence home that's like not very well run. It's kind of there's problems. His dad is dating another woman because his mom is too sick to be a wife, I guess. Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped a huge part. Before he goes out of town, his fiance dies in a car accident because he insisted on taking a cab to wherever they're going, dinner or something like that. And that cab crashes mysteriously. I guess you could say that the reason the cab, well, maybe not the reason, but something in the cab that happens that is a constant theme in this movie is that Shiro's friend who sucks pops into his head and he like thinks he's driving the car. So he's got this sort of like almost magical influence over Shiro. But anyway, the car crashes, the driver dies, his fiance dies, and his fiance's parents are very upset. Rightly so. That's when he gets a call about his mom, goes to deal with his mom. And then there's this whole second act of him dealing with the small little community of people at this convalescence home. One of which is his parents' neighbor, who is the daughter of a painter that his parents were friends with, who is now a drunk. And the daughter looks exactly like his dead fiance. His dad's girlfriend comes on to him a lot. They have a celebration. What is it? The 10-year celebration, annual celebration of the place. It's just wacky. It's like all over the place.
Yeah.
And like moment to moment,
There's his, the bridge scene.
His best, well, I'm getting there. His, his best friend shows up. There's this long proclamation about, like, his best friend basically calls every single person out. He's like, you're all bad people. You all have killed people. And, you know, maybe not like you put the knife in them, but you doctor, you know, malpractice, you cop, you accused a guy wrongfully and he ended up killing himself. Who else are you? You journalist, you wrote a story about a guy that was, you know, BS and it made him lose his mind and jump out a window or whatever. So there's this ongoing theme of sort of like everybody's guilty of being a shitty person. And then the wife and mother of the original drunk guy who got run over by Shiro and his friend show up. They convince him to meet on a bridge, a rope bridge kind of thing, which is very cool, over a big canyon. But then she dies. She falls off of it. And then his best friend pops up, as he's wont to do. He tries to kill Shiro. But he falls off the bridge too. So, like, everybody's just dying, falling off bridges. And then, okay, so then that's sort of the end of the second act. Then we just decide we go to hell. And it is...
because they all either eat bad fish or drink poison.
That's right. How does Shiro get there?
Isn't he in the scene where they drink around the table poison?
Yes, that's right.
When
that's
the
right.
clock stops.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly. And part of that, like, I don't even remember how the poison got passed around, but it was like a gift. It was like a liquor that I think the best friend brought, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so
the mother, yeah.
Oh, right, the mother. That's right. Yes. Okay, so it's like, as we said, it's kind of convoluted. It's wacky, but like you could kind of follow. It's just there's a lot going on. The hell sequence is wild. But the gist is that here we go. What we discover, or what the devil, I guess, sort of just like reveals is, see if you can follow me around this. Shiro's fiance was pregnant with his child. The daughter of the painter, who looks exactly like his fiance, is actually Shiro's sister, because Shiro's mother had an affair with the painter, and that child is the daughter that looks exactly like his fiance. Is that right? I'm pretty sure that's right, but I'm not 100% sure. Unless it's his fiance's mom who had the affair. That might be it. And that's why the daughter looks the same. I don't know. I started to really lose track at this point. All that matters is, is there's like a couple weird love triangles that we get.
Shiro finds Sachiko, but the reunion is interrupted by Ito, who reveals that Sachiko is his sister. So Shiro is actually Ensai's son, and Sachiko is actually Ito's daughter. Does that help at all?
Oh, that's right. Shiro is the painter's son. Yes. Oh my God.
Did that
it hurts my brain so much trying to sort out. It kind of doesn't matter, but you get the idea. It's nutso. Yeah. It's like this person was with this person before this happened, blah blah blah, etc. Like, but what the sort of thrust of the hell scene is Shiro realizing that he can kind of save his, well, dead child from his fiance, and that will kind of redeem him in this hellscape. But he has to track down that child who is in hell, in the sort of this particular area, which is the river that dead children who die before their parents go. It's like a limbo thing. Whew. And he does, sort of. He gets on a big wheel and then freeze frame and the movie's over.
After seeing the frozen clock again.
Everybody gets held up pretty gnarly. Everybody suffers some really gruesome, you know, death, like repeated death, torture, 8 levels of hell kind of stuff, which is really cool.
Tim, wonderful job. You were paying attention in class.
I watched the movie.
Yeah. Hey, great job.
Whew. Rough one, though.
And we hope you've watched it too. So, but if not, either way, that serves as a refresher. Great. All right. Well, then with that, if we're all ready, we can move on to our next section. How about it?
I think that's a good idea.
All right. Here we go. What worked?
What worked for you? In spite of that long diatribe of a summary, I like the weird, convoluted, like, plot. And all of these strange reveals, like the interconnectivity sort of thematic stuff. And it's all kind of, or literally, wrapped up in people, like their guilt around decisions that they made in life. And I like that stuff. I think that all, that thematically, that's really great. You know, even though it took a kind of meandering path to get there, ultimately, I was really into that.
Yeah, for me, I mean, again, the first watch, that's being able to follow the specifics, right. All that was kind of aside the point, because like I got, they were all guilty of sins and
yeah.
A lot of death going on, you know, like I got it despite all that. I will say, yeah, that ties to, I should say, like, the obvious best thing about this, coolest thing, is the imagery from the hell section.
No doubt.
So just aside from that, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
What you just said, all that's going on, the character, the drama, let's say, all that is, help support what I describe as an overall mood of the idea that just death is always impending.
Hmm.
That mm-hmm. just, you know, just even before the hell stuff at the end, there was just this tone and atmosphere to it where you just felt, it just felt dour and like you felt like you were at a funeral the whole time almost. Like from that, the opening shot of a, you know, like a real coffin and someone inside of it. And then it starts with that refrain that we hear throughout it, which is that sort of somewhere between chanting and singing Japanese style we heard mm-hmm. from Kwaidon. The refrain they repeat over and over and we hear at the beginning is, a human life is not but 2 scores and 10 years, which a score being 20 years. So human life being 50 years. We hear that throughout. And then just, yeah, then the ceiling of the coffin. And then everyone's dying, like you said. There's this car accidents, which I thought, I don't know, it was interesting. Both like the idea of, like there's the scene that was kind of around the train yards where kind of like Damien Omen 2, you know, train as metaphor in film. It's an often used metaphor, but here in the sense of, yeah, just a sort of unstoppable force. Kind of got a sense of just, which there you go, death, our mortality.
Also the transitive nature of a train, right? You're moving from one place to another, right?
Yeah. But then even just thinking about since it does happen more than once, the car accident thing of the car accident more so than the trains, it's sort of like, since people are, I mean, yeah, there's a train conductor, but as far as like we are the ones driving, you know, mm-hmm. the cars, mm-hmm. there seems to be something more embedded in that. I don't know about like a certain, I don't know, audacity is too strong of a word, but a certain kind of like taking life into your own hands, or, I mean, we know how dangerous and ridiculous cars are. Like, we know the statistics of car deaths, but we still have an infrastructure built around them.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy. But just something about like a certain, laughing in death's face almost. It feels like a sort of subtle everyday form of that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But then, yeah, then it just goes on with poisoning people. Just life is fickle and fragile, and it's throughout it. And that is very moody and got to me.
I think part of the why, or the reason or the why of this movie, the resulting moodiness and just the tone of it, is that it's a real roller coaster. I mean, like, moment to moment, and as well as scene to scene, you're going really highs, really lows, which is essentially just sort of it's the reversal thing in a way, and usually that's pretty effective tool to use to keep us on board and keep us kind of feeling like, whoa.
Wait, what do you mean? What highs and lows? What kind of highs and lows?
You know, so it's like, even just the beginning with Shiro in class, right? And it's a pretty like, no, it seems like a pretty normal thing. And then like his friend shows up and like throws a rose onto his desk. And it's sort of like, there's a lot of everything's chill. Everything's kind of heightened, like, oh my God, what's going on?
Yeah.
And then something nice happens, right? He sees his fiance, and that dinner's cool. But then his friend pops up again, and it's sort of like, it's constantly kind of going from like, oh, I think we're okay, to, whoop, nope, we're not okay, to like, oh, that was really bad. Like, let's regroup. And there's sort of this high, this loop-de-loop, or not loop-de-loop, but this up and down nature to everything that's going on. And it just carries through constantly.
It's often brought on by Tamura.
Very much so.
My assumption was that he was like a ghost, because the way he literally appeared and disappears and like replaces another person and then disappears is so like,
well, in the
Shiro
end,
is seeing him in that way. But then we gather, oh, wait, no, everyone's kind of seeing he is his
they
friend.
Call him a demon.
Okay.
He says, I'm a demon in the hell scene eventually.
Yeah.
Now,
but still,
does that mean literally, or is that just sort of like they're saying, oh my God, you're such a demon?
But it was interesting. It kind of felt like an early iteration of something like The Wailing, where we're really questioning whether someone has supernatural powers, totally, or is someone actually seeing this or not. What's
feels
going
very
on?
Trickstery.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
You know, so maybe that's just kind of the archetypal thing that they were going for. But I like that. I like this sort of sense of like, we're always constantly trying to reset the pins and then getting them knocked over and trying to reset them and knock them over. And it's kind of coming from all different angles. So I like all that. I think that creates this unsettling mood that you're always a little like anticipating the next thing.
Yeah. Whether like that when she falls off the bridge, when she's trying to shoot him and she falls off a bridge, the way like it was this interesting combination where like it kind of, you could tell it's fake, but at the same time it's like doesn't look fake. Like you're like, wait, but the body's moving. And then the way she hits the rock at the bottom, it's just gruesome. And
it is pretty gnarly. So, well, it makes you wonder, you're like, maybe that is what it looks like when a real body goes flying through the air. I don't know. It's just, there's a component of how the film is edited that I think adds to this feeling, this mood of, you know, almost you're never really on firm footing.
Well, think of like the opening credits set that up so well. Yeah. Like the it's almost like a twisted, eerie, like it's like a ghost Japanese James Bond intro or something like that. Mm-hmm. But the music, what it does, it's like doing one thing and then all of a sudden it cuts out and a voice comes on and says something, and then intense, weird, like acid jazz comes on. It's just all over the place. It's like Frank Zappa's weirdest stuff or something. And that's made me think that's a perfect example of what you're talking about, this kind of jarringness. These highs or lows can go anywhere at once.
It's got a surrealism sort of thing to it. Just hard cuts into, like, suddenly we're in a different place. And most of the time, what I do like about, because I'm not 100% on that style, I think it can work. But one of the ways they make it work in this is by, most of the time when they do a really hard jump into another scene, they don't jump into a lead up of a scene. They jump into the middle of a new scene. And so I think that's good. I think that helps that style carry on. Otherwise, you might get into this sort of, it would be start and stop too much, where you feel like you're never really getting anywhere. Maybe. But it doesn't matter, because this doesn't do that. Like, it does this other thing. And I think that's cool.
Yeah. Let's see what else. I mean, I'm just trying to think now pre anything before the hell stuff, because I just keep thinking of that now. Like, even when you said how quickly we transition, and I'm just thinking of God, yeah, when they transition to hell, he falls and then he's there.
What I like the most that gets paid off by us going to hell eventually is just how ugly everybody is as a person. And like, watching Shiro kind of quietly just move through that. Like, he doesn't really comment on anything. He doesn't push back on anything. He's kind of just an observer. I mean, he's suffering from his own kind of guilt. And like, I think that helps with us to sort of be like, relate to him as a character. But we're him, right? Like, the audience, he's our touchstone. And we're very much seeing the world through his eyes, even though that's not always the case, literally. But we sympathize with him and we relate to him. At least I think that's the intent, and I felt that way. So everybody around him has pretty big issues. Like, everybody, you know, his fiance's parents are, you know, mourning, but also the dad has some weird history that he's hiding. His best friend is, I don't know if you can put him into this category because he is this other sort of entity. But his dad, you know, is kind of a gross dude. The doctor in the town is kind of not a cool guy. He's not really helpful. Everybody there, and they have a scene where they call it all out, as I said, is just, they're really ugly. They're showing the ugliness that humans can be.
It was interesting too, just as commentary, like, it seems like, I don't know, this is maybe stereotyping like what I see in Japanese movies, or like, I was just watching that Ozu movie. Was it Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon, with the kids going around town? You know, the kids who just who want the TV. And it's like, so much is predicated on just like, everyone in this little village is just gossiping about each other. And it's just this sense of, yeah, I don't know, we're... you get that, okay, so everyone's gossiping at each other, but it's just like, so clear at a certain point, but everyone is like guilty of something too. So you just kind of go like, what are you all doing?
I think it kind of falls into that thing. I'm sure there's many different schools of thought of how you define this, but I kind of look at it just as like, you know, on the spectrum of self-actualization. Is that right? Actualization? Self?
You have it. Yeah.
That's right. Man, it sounded really weird coming out of my mouth. on the spectrum of that, the lower end of that spectrum is kind of this stuff.
Well,
everybody's kind of exhibiting the thing, the part of us that we should, I think, strive to not fall prey to.
Well, I feel like that's what I think of when I think of heaven and hell and these concepts. They're all metaphor for the present and your life. If at any given time, are you existing, so to speak, in the heaven that's available to you or the hell that's available to you? I don't think that was like intentional here. I think it was here. It's just sort of setting up bad people. They're going to go to hell. But it's just interesting how the metaphor carries over all the same.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I wondered if they were trying to lean. Oh, well, I guess is this a sort of a sin thing where we're actually like everybody's taking on a component of like sin or like, and I don't know the cultural overlap between like, say, the seven deadly sins is what, a Judeo-Christian thing? I don't actually know if that's entirely accurate, but seems like a European thing to me. Probably goes further back than that, but I don't know if Eastern culture and they do talk about Buddhism a fair amount at one point in the middle of the movie.
Oh yeah, I mean, in this movie they bring up Buddhism and its ideas of the eight levels of hell.
Oh right, yeah. So I don't know if there's an overlap with that stuff, but it's sort of regardless, it's the same gist of ideas that you can. There are different sort of components to being a good person and to a bad being a bad person, and you can fall into those, but if you do, you're gonna suffer the consequences.
Well, this is applicable right now. I was gonna say this to things of note, but naraka is the word of hell in the purgatory or hell realm in Buddhism. And they say a naraka differs from the hell of Christianity in two respects. Firstly, beings are not sent to naraka as the result of a divine judgment or punishment. And secondly, the length of a being's stay in naraka is not eternal, though it is usually incomprehensibly long, from hundreds of millions to sextillions of years.
Wow. Aggressive. I mean, that's a reason not to be a jerk.
Yeah, but again, wait, so it says a being is born into a naraka as a direct result of its accumulated actions and resides there for a finite period of time until that karma has achieved its full result. After its karma is used up, it will be reborn in one of the higher worlds as the result of karma that has not yet ripened. So wait, based on that, I don't understand how they're saying Christianity is not, or how naraka is not the result of divine judgment or punishment. It kind of sounds like that still, but...
It's the difference between so the judgment is exacted by an external rather than the judgment being a result of your action.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's not a third party involved.
Got it, yeah.
Whereas in Christianity, I think, whatever version you're looking at tends to have this notion of judgment. Like somebody's going to say, you're going to get to a certain place and there's going to be a being there that goes yay or nay.
Well, this is this version is more appropriate, I think, for that classic, like the heavy guilt that we get with like a lot of Japanese culture and stories.
Yeah. I mean, this felt very Greek, sort of to me, the same kind of archetypes and themes. It's, I forget which Greek myth it is, but there's the myth of the guy who goes to try and save his wife from Hades. And I forget exactly how it goes, but on the way out, they say, if don't look over your shoulder, and he can't resist, and he ends up looking over his shoulder, and that like condemns him. You know, it's got kind of this morality, mythological vibe to it. I quite liked.
Even down to like some of the scenes of like right before the hell scene when they drink the poison, that felt like you're reading it from an old fable or something.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That scene, I mean, it got to me too, of just the way she says, oh yeah, no, I'll drink it first. I'll prove it's not poison. And then they pass it around and all die. And just the way they're assured, like I was caught up in it too, of like, oh, this is fine to drink. We're all safe doing this. And then they all choke and die right there.
But
I don't know. That was also just that feeling of like, that eerie feeling of death is ever present.
Mm-hmm.
And just, oh yeah, we take for granted this thing is safe always. I don't know. It was
that scene and that sequence really, really reminded me of like the Dionysus sort of, Dionysus. There's a Greek, I think it's a Greek tragedy called the Bacchae or the Bacchus Bacchae. My friend directed it in college and she would kill me for not knowing exactly what it is. But it's got that same kind of thing, right? It's like, don't revel too much or you'll miss something, or like there'll be consequences that cost you, you know, your loved ones or whatever. Like it's got a very similar vibe to it. So I have no idea whether or not that, you know, was in the consciousness of the filmmakers, or if it's just it's a part of, you know, their mythos and they were pulling from that. Either way, it's good. There's a reason these stories continue to be told over all of human history, right?
It felt mythos-y.
Yeah. So I like all that stuff. That stuff's really cool.
Well, I guess just to bring us right up to the hell moment too, I loved the clock stopping. And I think they even said like a stopped clock is a bad omen.
They do. Yeah, that's right.
It stops right at 9:30. And then just to tie it all back too, I love how we go back to the frozen clock at the end. And also how it's shot where it's on its side ticking. Yeah. So the ticking of the clock is going up and down, which I don't know. That's visually, I think, on point with everything else we've been talking about is going on thematically.
I hadn't made that connection, but I wonder if then the gear, the giant gear that Shiro's son or daughter, I forget actually if the baby
daughter.
Is it a daughter? That the wheel that the daughter is on that he has to climb onto and like save her from, now that I think about it, is very much like the gear of a watch or a clock.
The one last thing I had on that stopped clock was I liked how we cut back to it at the end, because it almost made it feel like, rather than a broken clock, it was sort of getting at like time doesn't hold any weight, you know, in terms of like hell or death realms and the living realm. As if like in this single moment of time that they just died, everything we just watched just occurred.
Absolutely.
That's cool. That's why I kind of got out of cutting back to it.
I kind of felt like the whole movie was that you could just say this whole movie was, you know, a moment in the dozing of Shiro in class.
Yeah.
You know, like it really kind of had that feel, which I like that stuff. I like dreamy, weird, you know, what is real, different realms.
It could work that way where it feels like that of he's sitting in class, you're dozing off, and then like your friend throws the flower on there and then you're in the dream.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. All of that is cool. The archetypes are cool. The mythos is cool. The morality stuff is cool. So from a sort of baseline structural is not the right word, thematic,
conceptual
place. I really like all of that.
Great. Well, then how about onto the hell stuff? I mean, it's hard because it's like, it's all just great. Like you said, it's weird, it's wacko, but like every single visual, once we're there, it's just pretty captivating. Like from the get-go, and it's just so creative how the shots are done too, where they had some big old studio, empty studio to do whatever, big sound stage. And like from the get-go, I love when he falls. There's like the shot where it's like they have the camera upside down or whatever, so it looks like he's falling, falling down. He's just waving his arms or whatever, and there's smoke going behind him. It's so good.
I love how simple that is.
Yeah.
It's literally just turning the frame upside down of a guy from like the waist up holding his hands over his head going, ah.
Yeah, exactly. But then, so, I mean, so this just helped me out here. Some visuals that I just remembered and stuck with me, I got down, but the people buried up to their heads in the pits,
so good.
The river when we first see it that they're just marching out to. Then at the end, we talked about this wheel and the baby and him just sort of stuck on there, mm-hmm. like not able to reach her. I said the falling into hell. Laid out to them, first you will be flayed. And then we cut to this gruesome imagery where their heads are still together, but then their bodies are flayed. They're just like the bones and guts exposed.
And we watch them like pull the skin sack off of away from the body. So gnarly.
We have like naked women covering themselves, then that cuts quickly to imagery of snakes.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the spike pit area that they're getting impaled in.
I really like that there's one forced perspective shot. I mean, there's a few, but there's one in particular where Shiro is he's upside down with the spear through his neck. But he's super tiny he's like middle shot, super tiny. And then in the foreground is the devil's big head. And then there's another being on the other side, sort of mid ground.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And because it's all just surrounded in darkness, it gives you the impression that the devil is huge. And, you know, Shiro is the size of like what, maybe his nose. And he's right next to him. And then there's this other creature. I forget what the other thing is. It's like, I don't remember, who is middle-sized, you know, like kind of lording over it. But just that kind of stuff, that creativity and, you know, forced perspective things, or just camera tricks to give the landscape depth, or like the stacks of rocks stuff where it's super like we're camera on the ground with the rocks the foreground. And then like you get this sprawling kind of scene backing away from it. I really like that. That the visuals just they're just so fun all around.
Yeah. Not on the visuals, but just in the hell sequence, I thought it was really smart how they came up with it. But the thing with saving the daughter, basically, mm-hmm. because once you're in hell, you kind of go, okay, well, Shiro's, he's dead. They're dead. So like, what are our stakes here?
Right.
But so the idea though, and it's, I can't see what else like the stakes could be. That's so smart. Well, what if for some reason the baby's here in incarnation, like a parent wanting to save their child who's somehow stuck in this realm too? Like, that's the one thing where it's like, you know, they wouldn't be indifferent towards, you know?
Right.
It's a very strong motivating factor. And it's even though, despite him being dead, you'd still fight for.
Well, exactly. I mean, it gives us a third act to like, just a what do we even call it? It's a challenge. It's a thing that it's a task. Yeah. Right? He has to solve the problem.
Which just when he first goes down there, you're kind of like, well, where is this going to go? Like, I'd be down for just watching him descend to the different levels, but that is really smart how they did that.
Yeah. It's more along the lines of an adventure rather than us just watching people get killed or tortured.
Which is great, too.
But also happened. So doubling up.
Great. I mean, did you have any other specifics here? I mean, it's hard to
There's something really pleasing about the way once they are all just sort of a crowd of people frantically running around in like gray. Everything's gray. They're gray. A lot of them have like this sort of stockade thing around their necks. There's something about the way that is shot. I think what it is that they put the camera pretty far away on a very long lens and then shot into the crowd. So you have this really interesting like compression of the space.
Devil's
with this
eye
crowd.
View.
Yeah, it's super cool. And it's of a time, like, I don't know, it was triggering some sort of sense, like, nostalgia for me, but I don't exactly know how to, like, put my finger on it.
Yeah.
70s, I don't know, or something like that, even though it's the 1960. But it had this weird, cool feel to it, and I enjoyed it.
I think this is one of the shots you're talking about that I should just point out is like the one that maybe got to me the most in just some sort of like, I don't know, an eerie way. I just really felt it was when it's the group of people like you described all gray and they're crawling towards this like miniature water pit hole in the middle.
It's right after that, but yes.
Oof. Yep. Oh, that one's
so good.
Something about that really got to me.
Yeah. The water evaporating before they can get there looked really cool.
Just the helplessness of what they're doing and just the group of them all.
Yeah, I mean, we're in hell. We should be watching people suffer, right? Like, that's the idea.
Yep. Great.
Yeah. All in all, I mean, I think if you're in the mood, if you're in the right mood and you're and now having seen it, kind of being able to hold on to the story a little bit more, I think it's one of those ones that will be more enjoyable on repeated viewings.
And perhaps another have on at a party film for you. Does it make the cut?
The hell sequence certainly does. Like, without question.
I don't know. I kind of like
there
the idea.
There is a lot of really good stuff in the rest of the movie.
I kind of like
so.
That turn. You're just kind of, what is this like weird? Is this like Japanese crime movie? What is going on here? Right. And then all of a sudden.
Yep. Off to the races. Yeah, it was cool.
Great. One last one. I just got to point it out. This is one of those things. It's like only the Japanese know how to do this so well. And I love it so much. But all the screams throughout the movie, and there's so many. And I feel like I've pointed this out in other Japanese movies we've watched too, where like a good scream just gets me really jazzed up. And this one, there were just some whole sections where you're just cutting to person screaming, person screaming, person screaming. And just every time they're just giving it their all. It's great. I don't know what to say on it, but love those screams. Japanese know how to do it.
I definitely had a moment of thought when I believe it was his fiance was screaming in hell. That I was like, that's a good scream.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like just a fleeting thought of like, yeah. That's it.
Great.
That's why you got cast. No.
Awesome. Yes, last little thing I had. So with that, I think you're good, Tim.
Yeah.
We'll move on to our next section. What did not work?
It's not ready yet.
Seems to work okay.
No, something important's missing.
What did not work?
I mean, it's hard if this was just a first viewing thing or not, but I was kind of feeling what you had mentioned before. I don't know if I am totally on board with this concept, but you've mentioned before that in non-American films, there'll be a longer first act.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe if I was just feeling that a little bit, or maybe it was because I knew that we were going to go to a hell at a certain point. I was just waiting for it to happen. Maybe I was just getting lost in everything. But that first chunk felt long in a first viewing. So I don't know, like not huge what did not work for me, but it's kind of all I have.
Yeah, that was, I kind of agreed that there's sort of this seemingly aimless meandering throughout the whole, I guess, well, I don't know if you would even call it, to your point, if you would call it a second act, but let's just for argument's sake, say the middle hour of the movie. Maybe a little less than an hour. Let's say the middle 45 minutes. I kept just kind of thinking like, I'm just like, what, like, where are we going? Like, I know we're going to hell eventually, but like none of this feels like it's leading us there. It ultimately did. But there was a long section where I kind of just was like, I'm gonna check out if like I don't get something that I really can sink my teeth into.
Yeah, that's how I was feeling. And then it picked up for me when the mom passed away. I thought this is kind of like a clear, felt like a turned semi-inciting incident. I don't know. But then like I said too, and what worked, like there was still this overall like sense of impending death mood that I think was more than just knowing we were gonna be going to hell. So I don't know.
Part of me felt like this is a tricky thing, actually. I don't, you know, it's not something I think about often, but when you want your characters to at least be sort of related to archetypes, I think that's a good thing to at least have a sense of where you might place them archetypally. You don't have to be strict about it or anything, but I think it's important. I think the risk that can happen is if you over-archetype them, you inadvertently two-dimensionalize them if you do it too much, if you don't give them enough of them, of their own characteristics, if you rely on their character just being the archetype, because we know the archetype and the archetypes are, you know, long standing, and we can key into them easily. If you don't also give them character, or at least sort of expand the character a little bit in terms of the story you're telling, I think the danger is that sometimes it just becomes, the archetype becomes a little more like a caricature.
Are you saying that's what happened here a little bit, or that there wasn't enough of that to help follow them?
In the middle of the movie, all of these side characters didn't really feel like people to me. And I think part of that maybe is a result of leaning too heavily on us just kind of implicitly understanding the archetypes.
Well, it's weird because it worked with the trickster archetype friend character.
He works great. I agree. It's all the people in the small town. For some reason, I was just like, I get who you all are, but I don't feel like I'm getting enough to care about any of you. Maybe that's all it is, actually. Maybe I'm overthinking it. But it just felt very...
I mean, that's also, though, riding the line of it's upfront that these are all unlikable people. And
yeah. But yeah, part of it maybe is... Nobody has like an actual heart-to-heart conversation in this movie.
No, but I mean...
That's not this movie.
Exactly. That wouldn't be dour enough.
No, but as a result, I think it keeps us at a distance a little bit.
Yeah, maybe if they had something like that more upfront, I don't know.
Right, right. I don't know. It's an interesting thing, but regardless of all of that, it felt there. I don't know. It meandered a little into a territory where I was like, okay,
yeah. Well, again, I'm curious to see how this one sits with me, as things often grow on me, but we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, this is not a thing that didn't work, I guess.
Maybe is it a thing of note?
Yeah, it's a thing of note. How do I remember this one? I'll write a note to myself.
I mean,
right now.
I think we could just move on to things of note and you don't have to remember.
Okay, sure.
I don't have anything else.
I don't really either.
Great.
Okay. I have two things of note.
All right, here we go. Next section. Things of note.
Things of note!
This should be interesting.
Okay. So this is more note of note. I, your cat is snoring or something. So I have the feeling that I would really enjoy this movie if the goal with me watching the movie was to make it again. If I was tasked with remaking this movie, I think I would much, much more enjoy the movie because it'd be about digging into like a different way of looking at it to get the juice out of it to remake it.
So you're saying, since it's a more of a thing of note to point, you're pointing out that your non-default way of consuming a film would have made you enjoy it more.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is weird. It's not, that's certainly not a, it's not something that didn't work.
Yeah.
It's just weird. I found myself thinking, oh damn, there's so much cool stuff in here.
So, this movie, to having a really comprehensive understanding of it,
right,
would benefit it a lot. But at the same time,
I don't want to remake by any means, right? Like, I don't really like that as a general rule. So that's not what I'm not saying I'm compelled to remake it. I'm just saying if that were the setup, I think I would have enjoyed it more.
Yeah.
It's almost like it'd become more academic in a way. And I don't really want to watch a movie for academic purposes as a general rule.
But I don't know. It's I think the most important thing, though, a lot of time is that this the overall feel. Like, that is not the academic analysis. Like, that's what I think great movies sort of lend themselves to and what the show is all about. And I guess especially with the good ones. Yeah. But we absorb, then we go back to analyze what those feelings were all about.
I think part of what I'm feeling, and this is just, it's a, I guess it's sort of just a really basic way to conceptualize bridging the gap between myself and foreign films. That like the language barrier, having to read subtitles, like knowing that I'm visually going to be missing stuff unless I watch it again. And so wanting or like yearning for a experience with this movie or any foreign film, really, where I can close that gap. Like, those are hurdles in front of me, I feel like, and I wish I could remove them. And so conceptually, one way that I sometimes think is like, well, if I remade this, then I would be able to close that gap. But I never actually want to remake anything. So that's not like the goal. It's very just conceptual.
Got it. Got it. Interesting.
I have one more thing of note. Do you remember the moment that Tamura in hell spins away into the darkness?
Vaguely.
It's like the greatest sort of just, I don't know how to even quantify it. It's super dumb and super awesome.
I'm remembering it now.
And super goofy.
Yeah.
But like weirdly works. And he's like yelling, hands over his head and just twirling. But like slow twirling into the darkness.
Uh-huh.
It's just, everything about it is just so, what? Oh, cool, but not cool.
Yeah.
So I guess that's why it's a thing of note for me, because I'm like, I don't even know what to think of it.
That sounds like a what worked, because
it kind of is, I guess.
Because for something that's like eerie, disturbing, hell, inexplicable.
Yeah. I just kept thinking, I'm like, man, to be that actor in that moment.
Perhaps a precursor to the term Lynchian.
Yeah, for real. that's all I have though.
Great. Well, I just had some more things on the film. Well, I don't know how it is on the film itself. Outside of the story world, the filmmaking world, the response to it, it was very, very mixed, where apparently people either really enjoyed it or really did not enjoy it.
And shocking.
The general way to split up that consensus was the filmmaker said it was the younger people who'd enjoyed it more than the older people, which I thought was interesting.
That doesn't surprise me.
the younger people, they said, like, were just very taken by all its themes and the imagery, just all everything that we were just talking about. And it was the older people who sort of, maybe it was because they knew the context of it, that it was the studio's last film that was kind of rushed into production, that they said, oh, it was wasn't thought out enough. It's just kind of, I think they just kind of didn't maybe give it a chance. Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought this was fun too, where the screenwriters and the producer agreed to make a film that would be called Heaven and Hell. And when the producer read it, he said, well, what is this? This is just hell. And then the screenwriter's kind of retort to that was, well, we'll get to heaven in the sequel. So straight up just...
what a pitch.
Made hell, yeah.
Wow. You know, this, I guess, is a thing that worked. But let's just say it's a thing of note. to that point that this is just a movie of, like, it is just hell. I do like this, what do you call it? The sort of the premise of the world that is supposed to be reality is just as hellish and torturous as the actual hell that the character gets to.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what I was...
I love that.
That was kind of what I was pointing out as the definition. You know, heaven and hell are what's are either or available to us in our waking, waking reality, if you will. God, I mean, I don't know. How can I say this? It's just, maybe we're like, we're what you started saying, where my mind went. It's just kind of like an eerie thing. Is this the concept of like our reality here is this like just this kind of like shell of experience, and then these other realms that they get to in this movie of existence and after death are like the what it really is, you know? It's just a trip to think in terms of like, all right, here's reality. Now everything else of that is we agree is something else we don't know. But I don't know. It can be interesting to check up with the idea where that just the opposite is true.
Yeah,
I think that resonates with a lot of people.
Yeah, I can see that.
Great.
Well,
Tim. If we're going to wind down here with Jigoku, sounds like we're ready for that. We can wind down with some recommendations. We need a little, I want to hit a button and have some sort of laugh for that. Like, we don't need to stop to have a full transition. Recommendations.
We like, need like one of those like Halloween things where you like, you know, it's like a crow or a skull or a skeleton or something. You just push a button and it's like,
yeah, exactly. Well, until then,
yeah.
Recommendations.
I hope I didn't recommend Dead this last week. Did I? Did I recommend Dead Sex Education?
No.
Good, because that's what I'm recommending this week. It's a Netflix series. And it is... So generally speaking, I probably have said this before, I tend not to like gravitate toward comedies in general, and in particular, TV show comedies.
Okay.
But this is listed as a comedy, but it is the right, it's the perfect like combination for me of, it's a depiction of high school. It takes place in England, but it doesn't matter. It's super universal. The high school experience stuff that's in this movie.
Wait, it's a show or a movie?
It's a TV show. And it's very funny. It's about a kid whose mom is a sex therapist. He's like 16, I think. And through a series of events, people realize that he gives good sex advice. And they're high schoolers. And they're all, you know, trying to sort that out for themselves. So he sort of starts a secret clinic, essentially, for, you know, sex therapy for his peers,
like mother like son,
right? But man, just watch it. The characters are so good. The acting is fantastic. The best friend, that I should look up who the actor is, his performance is like freaky phenomenal. It's super, super touching, like bring you to tears every episode or on the verge of.
I mean, I love high school dramedies.
Yeah. So it's just hitting that perfect sort of note between comedy, quick, smart comedy, real life, and tragic, just the tragic absurdity of our existence.
Set modern day?
Modern day, yeah. It's cool. So good.
And remind us what it's called.
Sex Education.
Great. Available on Netflix.
Yep.
Cool. All right. Well, I was trying to round out seeing all of Sofia Coppola's movies I hadn't seen yet. I was so close. I was just like, oh, I've seen half of them. I just want to see the rest of them. So I triple featured The Beguiled, Marie Antoinette, and The Bling Ring. I loved them all, but the one out of those, if I had to pick one to recommend dead, would be Marie Antoinette. Did you see that with Kristen Dunst?
I don't think I watched the... I think I watched part of it. I don't think I watched the whole thing.
Let's see, actually, on Letterboxd. It does not have a Tim watch this.
Yeah, so if
time.
I didn't finish it, I didn't put it on.
Great.
I've seen maybe... I think I've seen 20 minutes of it or something. Like the middle 20 where I was like, well, I don't know what's going on, so I should stop watching.
It was just great. It was really funny. Don't know what else to say about it. I really enjoyed Marie Antoinette. Check it out.
Cool.
All right, Tim. Well, the hat's sitting right by you. I'd love to know what we're going to watch next week.
Would you now? I can make that happen if I can reach the hat without killing myself. All right. Here we go. Shuffle, 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 shuffle. Grab this one. It's bent. Oh, no, we already... Wait, did we watch this? No. Wait, did we? Did we watch? I've seen it. It's Event Horizon.
We have not dismembered Event Horizon.
I guess I watched it recently in my life.
Great.
Probably like 2 years ago.
Awesome. I think there's a new Blu-ray release of it. We'll try to get that. I haven't seen it since like high school.
Sam Neill, baby.
And that was, I believe, submitted to us by a friend.
Yep.
And we have a possible guest for that one. Who said they'd love to speak to it, speak about it with
us. Okay.
So let's see if that happens. To be determined.
Far out.
All right. I've been wanting to see it again. We'll finish our Sam Neill going insane trilogy for our show here.
Yeah. What did we do already?
Possession and In the Mouth of Madness.
That's right. In the Mouth of Madness.
Awesome.
Yeah. Sweet. Great.
Great.
Typecast Sam Neill.
All right. Well, until then, you can find us wherever you found us, or we got an Instagram. We got an email, all that kind of good stuff.
It's true.
Is that?
It's true. What have I been doing lately, social media? Oh, yeah, I make fun little things for the Instagram.
Great. Tim's going to make you fun little things for the Instagram. I post stills there of what we're watching.
Yep.
Really exciting. But either way, no matter what, we appreciated you being here. We appreciate you being here. We hope to see you again soon. And in closing, whatever layer of hell you may find yourself in, thanks for listening.
I'm in the third and a half layer, if you're wondering. We'll see you next time.
Goodbye. Goodbye.